Welcome to It's Bloody Complicated, powered by Compass. I'm your host, Neil Lawson. These are unprecedented times and we need to rise to the enormous challenges we now face, from the economy, climate change, to the state of our democracy and politics worldwide. This is the space to jump into the deep end and embrace the complexity. This podcast lets us hear from and question the best writers, thinkers, politicians, journalists and activists to share their vision, ideas and campaigns to build a good society, one that is much more equal, sustainable and democratic. It's Bloody Complicated is supported by our Compass members. If you'd like to gain access to live discussions and raise direct questions to our guests, join us and support our work. You can register at compassonline.org.uk/podcast to become a Compass member and join the next podcast. But for now, just sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of It's Bloody Complicated. On this issue of It's Bloody Complicated, we're delighted to be joined by two fabulous journalists, Ralph Baer and Rachel Shabby, to discuss just over 3 years of Keir Starmer's leadership of the Labour Party. Ralph writes for The Guardian, and before that he was at The New Statesman. He has a new book out any minute, and it's called Politics, A Survivor's Guide, How to Stay Engaged Without Getting Enraged. And I think we definitely need to do that. Rachel does and will write for anyone, everyone, everywhere. The Guardian, Prospect, The New Statesman, The New York Post, The Independent, The Times. She is absolutely everywhere, and it's a good thing. I'm so excited to have you two on the podcast tonight because I follow both of your works religiously and I like you both and I think you both write exceptionally well. This is going to be a great conversation. In binary terms, there are two takes on Keir. Take one is that he's achieved a remarkable feat already by making Labour competitive again after the disaster of 2019. Take two is that he will say anything to win, or he would say anything to win the leadership, and stands for little other than a sixth form play of New Labour. I suspect and hope we'll get a great discussion that rebounds between these two polar positions, because as ever, it's always bloody complicated. So we always start with, and this is, obviously you have to say not exactly where you are, but how are you? How are you feeling? So let's start with you, Rachel. Where are you and how are you?
I'm in North London. I'm trying to hang on to some sanity amidst a sea of political nonsense.
Okay. Let's help you do that. Let's get some life rafts and dinghies out.
Thank
for you.
Appreciate
well. We'll help as much. And a compass, because you need to know where you're going. Ralph, where are you and how are you?
I'm in Brighton and in a probably similar state to Rachel in that respect. I particularly slightly holding my breath now to get to the other side of local elections next week, because between now and that sort of data set dropping, I don't think there's a lot we can learn actually about what's going on in politics. So I like the morning after elections where you've actually got some facts, and the run up before is just sort of twiddling my thumbs, finding the campaigning tone of politics vile, unfortunately.
Yeah. And just so that people out there on the call and on the podcast know that we'll be kind of, you know, following the results really carefully, because our groups are working across the country trying to build progressive alliances, and we'll be trying to prove where they've worked over the weekend as the results come out from the local elections. So let's start with a kind of bigger overview. Maybe let's keep on with you going first, Rachel. Is the Starmer leadership what you expected, and how well do you think he has done in his first 3 years?
Well, I think the key thing about Keir Starmer in terms of expectations is that it is not what he said he would be. And that matters for several reasons, not least his own integrity and credibility, and the fact that it will be a drag and an attack line for the Conservatives to use. And indeed, we've already seen it come out as an attack line in interviews. He won the leadership on a platform of unity, very important to a party that was so in disarray in 2019, and also on pledges that were basically Labour left 2017 manifesto. And he's gone back on all of that. And I think, you know, the reason that matters is crucially in terms of party unity, but also in terms of actually having policies that meet the world as we see it today. And also, thirdly, as I just alluded to, the credibility problem. If you're going to go back on things you say you stand for, then that is reputational damage right there to yourself and your, you know, the perception of your honesty. So that's why all of these things really matter.
So in the real world, don't all leaders have to say this? You have to say what's going to win in a pragmatic kind of, you know, cautious, small C conservative country. After that terrible election loss in 2019, is there not an argument to say that that's what pragmatic political leaders have to do? You know, the audience in front of them wanted a bit of, you know, professionalised Corbynism. But the reality was, to win the next election, he had to move the party to the centre.
Yeah, I feel like that's a consensus that was reached after we realised that Starmer reneged on all the things. To be frank, I don't remember anybody talking in those terms during the leadership campaign. I don't remember anyone saying, oh, he doesn't mean any of this. He's just saying it to win the internal election. So I feel like that's a bit of a right history backwards thing. But also, I just think it's important to remember that it's not, I actually don't care who puts these policies in place, as long as they get put in place. You know, these are policies that match where we are, where the economy is. It also matches the polling on where people are. We've got even conservative voters, for the love of God, saying that they want to see renationalization of utilities. So that's the request. And that's why I don't think it should be framed as, you know, unreasonable in the context that we're giving it.
Just one more quick comeback before Raph, but he's 15% ahead. Isn't that all that matters?
I think that his own people would acknowledge the problems with the polling there. Is it that he is storming ahead? No, the party is ahead because the Conservatives have collapsed. In terms of personal rating, he's neck and neck with Sunak. So I don't think even his own people would be comfortable with where the polling is right now.
And could everyone note how ferociously neutral I'm being so far? It might not last, but I'm going to try and keep it up and see if I can. Raph, over to you. So is he what you expected and how well do you think he's doing?
Well, I'll start actually just where you just left off, because I do think it's worth pointing out that if he wasn't 15 points ahead, I mean, if it were sort of behind or it was much closer, he would certainly be getting the blame for that. And so it's probably worth at least considering the possibility that he deserves some of the credit for the lead. I came at this actually from a very different position to begin with, which is I didn't expect very much of him from the leadership contest, actually, precisely because I thought it was probably a mistake to commit to so much continuity with the Corbyn project. When, you know, on the 13th of December 2019, it seemed as if, you know, you were facing two terms in opposition and the whole thing was a sort of a smouldering crater. I think, you know, again, to be fair to Keir, I don't think it was duplicitous, actually, what he did. I honestly, you know, both from what little I know of him personally and from conversations with people who've worked with him, I think he genuinely, you know, the idea that there should be a way of, as you put it, sort of professionalizing a bit of Corbynism, you strip out, you know, the bits that were really rebarbative to large parts of the electorate, and you don't oversteer, was his expression. I think he sincerely thought that was something he could do, and it was actually a process of confronting the evidence of what people were saying, particularly in the seats Labour has to win, and actually meeting those voters and having that, so having his sort of nose rubbed in that, that sent him on the journey that he's been on. Now, that said, I'm actually, so having sort of come started from a position of not being terribly impressed, not thinking he would be okay, but not necessarily trusting him all that much, then thinking, oh, actually, I've underestimated him. He's building the plane while flying it. I think he's getting to quite an interesting place. I've now sort of settled back down into a slightly skeptical view. And that's as much to do with, and here I agree with Rachel, the sense that if he is on a journey, or if he is going to repudiate what he stood for before, he has to have a level of performance capability and to articulate what the destination of that journey is in a way that both explains the trajectory and accounts for the inconsistency. And I worry that he simply doesn't have those capabilities. And I think in terms of, you know, having a more radical left program, I think it's probably true that there is a wider audience for that in the country than the immediate team around the leader of the opposition now think is the case. But I think to win that argument in with a sceptical audience, people who didn't vote Labour in 2019 and very, very passionately didn't want Jeremy Corbyn to be prime minister, you need to be better at a lot of the politics than Keir Starmer currently looks.
You want to come back on any of that, Rachel? I think that bit about the you know, not having a narrative for his own narrative, I think will come back and haunt him very, very strongly. You know, I mean, the Tories will obviously do that. You said this, now you say that. How can we, you know, it's not whether you're left wing or right wing, it's whether we can trust anyone who changes their position that much. Are you surprised that he hasn't got a kind of better narrative for the big shifts he's made?
No, because I think that we can see from the people around him where the, you know, who they are and what they stand for ideologically. And I also think we're in a media political narrative where people will cut him a lot of slack. So he doesn't, you know, unless it's to attack him as in, okay, you've reneged on that. He's not actually, until very recently, had many people saying, okay, but you haven't got a narrative and that's the problem. It's mostly just been relief that Labour is polling ahead. And of course, great, you know, I don't resent or begrudge that. You know, I think that's a good thing. But because we have a narrative that wants this sort of managerial looking guy who keeps saying, I'm not Corbyn, to do well, there perhaps has been less pressure on him, both internally and externally, to develop that kind of narrative, and perhaps an underestimation of how big a problem that is. And we can see how big a problem it is, and we can talk about it later, in terms of the polling of, you know, what people think about who he is and what he stands for.
I think he probably also deserves a little bit of slack because actually the first 2 years of being a leader of the opposition, which is your audition with the country, he was just not part of the political story at all. And there wasn't an obvious way in.
Oh, there were plenty of obvious ways.
No, I see. There, I disagree. And I think an awful lot of people there. I think there are people on the left and people who, you know, up until there was a point where the Boris Johnson project really started to implode. Where you had a line in, and actually I think he took the right position there. But certainly at the start, there are an awful lot of people for whom the pandemic was not a political event, and they didn't want to hear the leader of the opposition making political capital out of what was perceived largely as essentially a national emergency, a national crisis. And I think that was, for any leader of the opposition, that was an incredibly difficult thing to do. And he was basically starting out with a sock in his mouth. And yeah, that, you know, along with other deficiencies that he may have had, that were sort of native to his project, I think that was hard. So he, okay, you know,
you've got the pandemic, which is creating a widespread awareness of, number one, the people who really count in the workforce in the UK, and number two, is fostering a sense of, oh, maybe we do need a sense of collectivism and community and cohesion, responsibility to each other. Maybe we need a welfare state and an infrastructure that supports that. Basically, people going back to cohesion and public services in a really big way, even if they're not capital P politicizing that. That is just pure hay everywhere for a left leadership to capitalize on. He didn't. It was an opportunity that was squandered by the left.
Well, it is still an opportunity. I'd agree with you there that the difficulty he seems to have had in articulating the sort of the social democratic impetus that was contained in that moment. I agree. That was definitely a missed opportunity. But
maybe we can acknowledge that was a missed opportunity.
See, my problem, Raph, isn't that, I mean, I think that was I think it was both a missed opportunity and it was a very hard opportunity. But my problem has been, I mean, because, you know, I cut my teeth in the run up to 97. My teeth are very old. And that was like a real serious political project. be serious people with deep thinking and deep analysis and, you know, a deep prescription of what needs to happen in the most benign economic circumstances. My frustration is that he didn't use those 2 years, whether his sock was in his mouth or not, to do any deep thinking at all, as far as I can see. And there still doesn't seem to be any at all. I mean, do you see any, Ralph? Or do you hear anything?
No,
anything that gives you any kind of assurance?
No, my I think my biggest criticism at the moment of the position as it stands is it doesn't express an argument about what Labour will do for the country. And that's not the same. I mean, the sort of the cliche is that, you know, leaders of the opposition are always expected to have a vision, and then, you know, that's a sort of macro demand, and the micro demand is you must have a memorable slogan, you know, an answer to the question, I'm voting Labour because, and it should ideally be a three-word sentence, you know, like take back control or get Brexit done, whatever it is. And he doesn't have either of those things, which might be a problem. But actually, as you say, in the mid-1990s, there was a narrative argument about where Britain had come from, and you could agree or disagree with what the third wave proposition was, but it was a coherent argument. In the same way, actually, and I'm sure most people on this call would very profoundly disagree with the argument that David Cameron, where everyone would disagree with the argument that David Cameron and George Osborne brought to the country in 2010 about not having mended the roof when the sun was shining and what the requirement was for budget austerity as a response to the global financial crisis. It was insane, but it was actually an argument that they were making about what had to be done. And I don't know what Keir's argument is now. And it should be something, as Rachel was just saying, about the appetite for solidarity that was revealed during the pandemic, and, you know, how you extrapolate that in, you know, and there is a separate problem there about to what extent you're expected to be sort of to have fiscal discipline as part of that story, which we might disagree about. But either way, he's not doing that. And that, I think, is a big problem. So it looks like a kind of end of peer tactical tribute to what happened in the mid-1990s, which is not equal to the moment that we're in now.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's go all tabloid for a second. Rachel, can you think of a good thing that he's done? And what's the worst thing do you think he's done?
Good things. I can think of good things if I think hard. So some good things are policy things. The 28 billion of green capital investment each year until 2030 is good. That's the kind of thing that we need to see in the face of the climate emergency that we're facing. The Great British Energy thing is good. The fair pay agreements to tackle poverty wages, good policy. Scrapping non-dom rules is also good policy. All of these have got caveats, right? I think that the devil is in the detail with all of these things, but generally going in the right direction and starting at least a glimmer of a grasp of the urgency of the moment that we're in and the need for policies to tackle that. And that's not just climate emergency, obviously, that's economic, housing, collapsing NHS and all the rest of it. I cover racism a lot. So the thing that has been the worst from my perspective is the way that the Labour Party has salted the earth for progressives, for the progressive base and for anti-racists, minimizing or ignoring complaints of Islamophobia and anti-Black racism in the party, ignoring the Ford report, which pointed very clearly to the problem of creating a perception of a hierarchy of racism, the disgusting racist briefings about Muslim people around the Batley and Spen by-election in 21, the blatant race baiting of the Sunak attack ad, just the overall reluctance to adequately challenge the vicious framing of the government's immigration bill and general immigration policies. For me, that has been horrendous to watch and something that has caused endless rancor and division within the progressive left.
Mm. Mm, yeah, it doesn't sound good. Raf, what's the best thing and the worst thing for you?
In policy terms, I agree. I think the particularly, if only it was better amplified, but the Green New Deal construct as a way of sort of talking about what the state can and should be doing as both a recipe for future growth and something that necessarily has to be done. I wish they'd find a better way to make that a sort of a for want of a better term, a headline grabbing component of what they do. I think he called the the dealing with Boris Johnson, actually, I think he actually called that right in terms of when and how he articulated, you know, he bet quite heavily on the fact that Johnson would just simply implode because he was dishonest and incapable at a time, bear in mind, when a lot of people, sort of serious Westminster commentators, were saying this man will basically dominate the political scene, you know, unopposed for 10 years. He got that right. Now, Rachel will very profoundly disagree with me on this, I'm sure, but I think the idea that Labour could get back within to a competitive position, possibly challenging for government in one term without a thorough repudiation of Jeremy Corbyn and what he had represented to a large part of the electorate by 2019 is for the birds. It was clearly necessary that he did that, I think, to make Labour electorally competitive, and he did it. So that, I think, is good. The downside, I agree, the Sunak attack ad really was one of the most dispiriting things I've seen in well, just recently in any politics. I mean, I sort of expect that from the Tories. And I think it was a squandering of moral capital in a sort of crass attempt to do something that, even if Labour should, there's a case for Labour doing something like it in terms of being sort of pugilistic in their attacks, not like that. Not with the sort of racist connotations that were there in that particular ad. That was just appalling. I think just the generally that the point, I'll just go back to the point I made earlier, that there is a failure to seize all the opportunities he's had. You know, he doesn't, the way I'd put it actually is like this. I think a winning candidate likes being in the limelight, you know, so actually craves the attention that he wants from that is possibly available to leader of the opposition. And Keir Starmer always looks as if he's slightly resenting the fact that he's expected to explain himself. And he looks like he's sort of, when the limelight falls on him, he's reaching for the sort of factor 50 to sort of block it out. And that sense that he is not communicating with pleasure, with passion, with urgency, what you would get from a Labour government, I think is going to cause a lot of difficulties in the next 18 months, because you've got to campaign to win this thing.
But isn't that the public embodiment of quite a confused politician who's shifted around a lot, who was on the left and then it's quite hard. I mean, you can't fake, you know, authenticity, I think, can you?
I think it was my friend John Harris who wrote a very good piece recently, who put it very well. He said the problem isn't that Keir Starmer's reminiscent of New Labour in 1997. He's reminiscent of New Labour in 2006. You know, there's the point at which it had become this slightly desiccated, technocratic thing that was so afraid of accidentally articulating social democratic principle that it just came across as not really believing anything at all. And I think that was a depressingly fair criticism, I think.
So in terms of other leaders, Rachel, is there kind of anyone that he reminds you of or is most like? And then what do you, you know, what can he do now to kind of redeem himself? So who's he like? And, you know, is there anything he can do now to put him back in your or in your good books?
I mean, I'm not very good at the who's what other leader is he like thing. I'm a nerd, but I'm not that particular kind of nerd. But what I would say is that it's been interesting to see how not like Joe Biden he has turned out to be, because you'd look at it and you think on its face, okay, both of these guys are, you know, they're not my guy in either case. I'm left. and these guys are, you know, the moderate centrists. And it's interesting to me how Biden moved. And he moved for two reasons. First of all, he looked at his left flank and he thought, I cannot afford to ignore this left flank because, first of all, they have great policy ideas. And secondly, the canvassing power of this left flank is so big that it would be stupid to purge it. And I'm saying those words very pointedly. And the second thing that Biden realized is, well, whatever I, nice moderate centrist, think, the reality means that I have to change, right? The reality of the climate emergency, economic reality, the fact that for anyone under 40, it looks like there are no real prospects of anything like the sort of life that their parents would have had. And so he had to shift tack, and he did this, you know, once in a generation, £1 trillion infrastructure investment plan that had wired into it a climate program and a jobs creation program. And those two things were intertwined. And so his capacity to see why he needed the left and the reality he is in is something that I look at and I think, well, why isn't Starmer able to get there? And that is an open question.
And just, Raph, same to you, but is there anyone he reminds you of? And what does he need to do next? And maybe reflect on Rachel's comments there in the sense that Biden has co-opted the left in a way that, you know, Starmer has obviously completely rejected, you know, the left. And why the difference?
Well, I think part of the difference, bluntly, is that he's not as talented a politician as Joe Biden or Albanese in Australia, who is an interesting comparator as well. And I don't mean that he's not a talented or a smart man. The emphasis there is on politician. I mean, Biden was in the Senate for decades. He was vice president. I mean, that is a man who knows a lot about politics. And I think Keir Starmer, it's easy to forget that he doesn't come from the sort of envelope stuffing, doorstep knocking school of Labour politics. You know, he came to it quite late, and he was parachuted into it, quite a weird shadow cabinet. I mean, unusual in the sense of that whole year 2015 to 2019 era. So that's part of it. But also, as you've said, I don't think he actually has. This is going to sound harsher probably than I mean it, but I don't think he has sort of abstract conceptions of what politics is for in his head. He's a prosecutor and a problem solver. And the problem he's trying to solve is, how do I win? And when then he looks at the data and he looks at what sort of electoral tactics ought to be that will deliver that. And some of that is about the electoral system and the constituencies he has to win. And that leads him to a very narrow set of sloganeering propositions that are meant to target a particular group of people. And it's not politics in three dimensions in the way that's going to excite anyone else. And I think that's a serious problem. I mean, you know, leaders say he's like, I mean, I suppose a very generous comparison might be Harold Wilson, you know, someone who people thought was a bit slippery, played different factions, you know, essentially pretty ruthless and cynical in the way he gamed things. I don't think that really stands up, but I can see how, I mean, maybe it does in terms of, you know, needing a couple of elections to get over the line. I don't know. But actually, I think in a way, and this is, again, going to sound a bit harsh, and I think temperamentally and in terms of what they believe, I think they're very different. I think a possible scenario that we're looking at here is actually David Cameron in the run-up to 2010, where all of the momentum ought to have meant that this person basically wins a majority, because you've got this 13-year-old government. It's on its arse. People have lost trust in it. You've had the Iraq war. Everyone's tired. You've had a financial crisis. New Labour by that stage was throwing power away. I mean, they sort of radiated this craving to get back into opposition, some of them, as you know, Neil. And Cameron should have won. He'd done everything sort of on paper right, but he didn't, because there was some gap there. There was some trust problem. And then you had, weirdly, Cleggmania. You had this thing that meant suddenly he didn't make it. He didn't get the majority. And that, I think, is very possibly the trajectory that Keir Starmer is on.
I keep thinking about Robert Redford at the end of the film The Candidate, where he's won and says, well, what happens now?
The comparison I'd use, I think, is actually it's in The Great Escape, where there's that scene where they dig the tunnel, they've got all the papers ready, they're in their civilian clothes, and then they come out of the tunnel and they're short of the woods by 20
yards. That's very good. I like that one. Look, we're going to move over to members in a minute, but because this is Compass, you have to help us think through where we're at with kind of potential progressive alliances, and will Labour ever back PR? Rachel, what do you think?
Is this the moment where I'm supposed to say, of course he will, because it's a wonderful idea and one we should all embrace?
What's the reality? I mean, what do you think about, you know, our campaign around progressive alliances and will Labour ever back PR?
Look, the guy can't even build progressive alliances within his own party.
Yeah.
And that's a really big deal. We talk about, you know, what's going to happen in the election. I mean, you're going to need all those people to campaign on the ground. Cutting them out of the process isn't going to help. And I can't even describe that how demoralizing it has been for Labour Party, local Labour Party, constituency Labour Party members up and down the country to see themselves locked out of the candidate selection process and how short-sighted that is. So I just want to give you one example because it's one I know. And you look at Broxtowe. So in Broxtowe, which I visited last year for a piece for The Guardian, looking at what the local Labour Party were doing, which was basically community building, community organising. On the back of the pandemic, they did loads of food banking. They organised a food bank. They helped support and set up a community centre with a local neglected football club in a marginalised area. The food bank work they did was with a local Muslim food bank. So they're sort of organically building the kind of community cohesion that you want in those sort of areas. And they were building trust, right? Because they were showing up all the time in areas where trust for politicians is zero. And Labour locks them out. It locks out their candidate who has support from eight unions and across the factions in the party. He's blocked from standing. The entire executive committee resigns because what even is the point? And so who are the people that are going to do the kind of work that they did? You know, so first of all, sucks for the community that they're actually in. But secondly, they're not going to come and support you, are they, during a campaign? They're not going to be the ones that are leafleting. They're not going to be the ones that are, you know, doing your signal boosting in the local community of what a Labour Party, what a Labour government would bring. And so the short-sightedness of losing those people, and you can scale that up across the country, because that's just one constituency example. The short-sightedness of that, just for what Raff sees as a necessary disassociation from Corbyn, is just it's extraordinary. It's so stupid. It's purely factional and ideological driven. And so a party that can't even get past that, I don't really see embracing PR anytime soon.
I think you may have a point. Raff, what do you think?
If Labour win a majority, they're not going to embrace PR. There's no question about that. Yeah. The way you get to PR is falling short of the majority and having to do a deal, and PR getting on the table that way. And you know, there are many reasons why that's the case. And you've probably discussed it on podcasts past him, so I won't go into it. I think in terms of what will actually happen before polling day, I'm quite optimistic about the extent to which just tactical voting and tacit alliances will happen anyway, for the simple reasons that I think from 2016 onwards, there has been a general broadening of understanding within the electorate that's what you have to do and that's how it works. That's both technological in terms of the apps and just a sort of a general, you know, just a better facilitation of understanding what has to happen. And also, I think crucially, time has healed some of the resentment against the Lib Dem. Labour people will vote Lib Dem in a way that they wouldn't have done. You know, the coalition thing has sort of moved on a bit. And so on. So I think the just get the Tories out impetus is sufficiently potent now that it will really help reduce the number of Conservative MPs at the next election, which is essentially the main thing that has to happen. And then, you know, once that's happened, then you can worry about being disappointed that there's no PR, or disappointed that Keir Starmer's even less progressive than you hoped he might be. But up until polling day, that's a job.
And keep going, Raff. Is he going to win?
Who, Keir Starmer?
Yeah.
Is he
going to be Prime Minister?
Oh, well, yeah, that's a different question. On balance, because, you know, Tories plus DUP, I suppose, they need to get to 320. And whereas Labour can fall a fair bit short of that and still find a way to make Keir Starmer Prime Minister, I would say, yeah, it's odds on he's Prime Minister. Will Labour win a majority as things currently stand? And he has surprised me on the upside before, as well as disappointing. As things currently stand, I think we're falling short of the woods. I think we're stuck in a tunnel.
Rachel, is he going to become Prime Minister?
I'd say that's about right. I mean, on the face of, you know, the way the polling looks right now, yes. But I don't think it's going to be the big majority that he was perhaps hoping for. And I also think, you know, the problem then is, what do you do if you win? What then? Because ideally we want more than one term of a Labour government, and we want a Labour government that actually does something useful and substantive. And that's my worry. What are you going to do when you're in power? Because if you don't deliver, you're going to get people even more annoyed, and you're going to lock out the chances of progressivism for even longer in this country.
Yeah. So I've just literally seen pinging up in the comments someone making the point about what's happening in Scotland and changing calculus. And that's an excellent point. I think that really does. I mean, the fact is, Labour don't get majority without, never had a majority without a lot of seats in Scotland. And the absolute catastrophic implosion of the SNP has got to, you know, at least if you're a bookie, you'd be looking at that and shifting your odds in favour of Keir Starmer being the next Prime Minister.
Hello, Samuel here from the Compass office. I hope you're enjoying the discussion so far. It's Bloody Complicated is brought to you by Compass, and it's made possible by the support of our amazing members, like Eliza. Here's Eliza on why she joined the Compass community.
My name is Eliza. I've been a Compass member for about 3 or 4 years, I think. What drew me to Compass was the fact that it's cross-party and it's also not a party. I had a light bulb moment about elections, which was, no one's going to win except the Tories under this system, and we have to work together. Having been previously a member of the Labour Party and then joining the Green Party, I really wanted to see parties working together, and we have people that are politicians, MPs, trade union leaders, etc. And it's quite level. There's no big hierarchy. It's quite an honest, open space where people come together. You will hear from people from all around the political spectrum actually debating the hard stuff. It's actually, let's find a solution to the problems that we have and let's do it together. We need this progressive alliance. And I would like to see people who are passionate about getting the Tories out in the next election and getting proportional representation in. Come and join Compass now and actually swell the movement, because without people, there's no power. And that's what we need right now.
Find out more about joining the Compass community at compassonline.org.uk/podcast. And now, back to the discussion.
Fabulous. Okay, Harry, over to you, and let's get some much better questions from our much better members.
Great. Just bringing in Blair to ask her a question.
Right. My question is, should incidents like Braverman's 1930s Germany-style rhetoric against immigrants and her declared intention to ignore EU rules, plus the police crime and Barclay's attempt to make nurses' strikes illegal, be a red light to us? Do they tell us that we should stomach issues with Starmer because the next general election will be a clever opportunity for a dangerous return populist movement to the far right? Or is the UK too well established a democracy to be a real risk? Thank you.
Right, thanks, Claire. I'm just going to bring in Catherine as well, just to ask her a question.
Hello. I was actually thinking about my question as Rachel started talking about Biden and the people he needed to bring on board to increase his support. Surely there's a natural constituency for Labour and Starmer. If only Starmer would start banging the drum about the environment. People, young people are particularly concerned. So two issues here. One, it could increase his election chances. But secondly, it just might do something for a world that I am seriously in fear of what is going to happen. So in the context of that world that might be rapidly reaching, probably is, an environmental tipping point, isn't it frightening that Keir Starmer is missing this opportunity to promise a young electorate a vision of hope that something is actually going to be done that will safeguard their future? Thank you.
Wow, those are brilliant questions. Those are really big questions. Claire, that is massive and very important. What I would say to that is, I think we are in a very sort of populist right landscape in terms of what the Conservative Party is pumping into our air supply. It is very dangerous and divisive. And I think that I'm not convinced that the Labour leadership is up to it. I don't think they've quite grasped the moment, because you don't, you know, they're essentially reinforcing the framing, which is divisive and ugly, that the right wing is imposing upon us nationally with things like the immigration rhetoric. They're not adequately challenging the operational premises of it. You've got, you know, Rachel Reeve saying, well, the government's not deporting enough people or fast enough. You've got Yvette Cooper promising more security issues around controls of immigration. You've got Starmer saying, well, yeah, some asylum seekers should be tagged. I mean, you don't get any of them actually question the fundamental far-right, divisive rhetoric that is being pumped out by the Conservatives. And that is very dangerous, because every time a Labour politician says something like what those three have said, all they're doing is reinforcing the frame. And the only people that will ever gain from that are the right wing, because the right wing do that better. There's no point taking, you know, a light version of racism when you can take, you know, the full version. And on the question around the climate emergency, I completely agree. I think there's a fundamental mismatch between the scale of the emergency that we are facing, which obviously is horrifying young people, but obviously much more broadly, and the policy responses that our politicians are coming up with. And I'm reluctant to keep doing this, but I think it's important that someone does keep doing this. And that's to point out that the intellectual strength, the intellectual ideas and power and thinking around these issues are coming from the left. The right of the party doesn't have the substance and the thinking on this policy stuff. It hasn't had it for a long time. And so again, there's a penalty for not engaging the left, in that you don't get the benefit of the pluralism and the force of their ideas. We are seeing some stuff come up, and I don't want to dismiss what they are doing in terms of green policies. The green capital investment is a good thing, right? But I just don't think it's moving far enough or fast enough to match the reality of the emergency that we're facing.
If I could take the two things in reverse order. I mean, plainly the environment is the number one issue for everyone on the planet, and it's a source of frustration that if the opposition leader isn't able to articulate that properly, that is obviously clearly a deficiency. I think there's also a peculiar irony here, in that actually it's not an issue. I mean, it might be true, as Rachel says, this is something that the left is doing the hardest thinking about, but it's certainly not an issue that belongs exclusively to the left. And actually, perversely, if it is true, as I think it is, that the current Labour leadership is thinking very hard about how to persuade people who vote Conservative previously, voted Conservative in 2019, to vote Labour instead, which is how you win elections in this country. Actually, there is a Conservative argument for environmentalism, and there are lots of people who vote Tory who actually care passionately about the environment. And actually, they're sort of missing a trick there, even on their own sort of tactical game plan, in not making essentially a more Conservative case for environmentalism in terms of growth, in terms of self-sufficiency, in terms of independence from Putin's energy supplies. There are all sorts of things that you could say that would persuade Tory voters to vote Labour connected to the environment. So that's a missed opportunity. In terms of the far right thing, look, I for as long as I've been writing and about politics and following it, there has been a tendency to fret that every Conservative policy is the beginning of a slippery slope that ends in the Third Reich. And that has never quite been the case. And it has sometimes sounded like rhetorical hyperbole and sometimes been counterproductive. I think that is not the case now. I think the threat is different. And we see what's happened with Donald Trump. I mean, that's a fact. That's actual fascism. And that is the seedbed that is growing the weeds that are now spreading and infiltrating the Conservative Party, and Conservative ideology is now going in that direction. So whereas previously, I think, you know, if you'd asked 5-10 years ago, I might have been more cautious about that. Now I agree. I think there is something genuinely very, very frightening about what is happening to right-wing nationalist ideology using the Conservative Party, sort of, that has sort of parasitized and taken over the Conservative Party. And for that reason, it is, I just think it's absolutely imperative for the future of British democracy that the Conservatives lose the next election. That's just a simple, I think it's now a moral proposition that it is essential that the Conservatives do lose the next election. And also, I would add to that, although whatever frustrations and irritations we might have with Keir Starmer's inability to articulate things or borrowing frames that in reinforce, and those are true arguments, the valid arguments about disappointing things that Keir Starmer has, but the suggestion of equivalence that sometimes, I'm not saying that's what Rachel was doing there, that she wasn't, but sometimes that criticism of centrist Labour and the centre-left or centrism or liberalism shades into a kind of proposition of equivalence that actually doesn't make any difference because basically they're Tory light. They are not, it's not the same thing. And it is absolutely, whatever else happens, it is much, much better that Keir Starmer becomes the Prime Minister by 2025 than any current Conservative MP gets that job. And ultimately that, for me, that is the bottom line.
I'm just going to bring in Tony.
Hi. Yeah, great discussion. It's not a pretty situation, but with the political political system so heavily stacked against Labour, it's striking, I think, that Starmer is desperate, absolutely desperate, you know, not to slip up, you know, not to be crucified like Miliband and Corbyn. And you're sort of mindful of the Ming Vase image that Roy Jenkins produced of the, you know, the Labour leader, a man with a Ming Vase, you know, going across the polished floor, moving incredibly cautiously. And isn't the sort of bottom line here really that Starmer is caught between a rock and a hard place? I mean, too cautious and he's condemned from his left flank, and too radical and he gives you know, baseball bats for the Daily Mail and the Tory press to beat Labour with. So that would be my question. If I could just throw in a supplement as well, I mean, is there any sort of possibility that the sort of persona that he's presenting, you know, this cautious persona, could be an act, and that he sort of flowers into a glorious butterfly after the election?
Right, thanks, Tony. I'll just bring in Joanna.
Yeah, I'm just slightly repitching my question because I think, you know, Raf and Rachel have probably addressed it, but we desperately need socially progressive policies and an alternative to the current self-serving and corrupt government. The Tories didn't stick to a traditional way of doing things. They didn't worry about alienating part of their centre, and they were deeply radical. What is it going to take? Who is it going to take to get Starmer to have the courage of convictions and articulate a more radical, progressive and socially just, I was going to say agenda, but I think vision and agenda.
Great. Thanks, Joanna. We could hear from that first.
Yeah, that second one's a hard question. That is a really hard, because look, and it's related to the first question. I mean, it is certainly true that, you know, the caution and the timidity has, yeah, there is a good explanation for it, which is exactly the one you're given, that you know, part of the job of being an opposition, a Labour opposition in particularly after 2019, after the legacy of Jeremy Corbyn, has had to be reassurance. There are an awful lot of people, and this is just the polling and a lot of, you know, things I've heard from across the political spectrum will bear this out. There are an awful lot of people who don't vote Labour because they are afraid of what a Labour government will do. And if that's unfair or based on mythologies or based on fictions that have been confected by the right-wing press, it doesn't change the fact that it's a reality that the leader of the Labour Party has to address. Now, unfortunately, I think, you know, what Tony Blair was able to do and that Keir Starmer is unable to do is, first of all, benefit from, I think, generally a much more benign economic environment and a sense of and a probably a higher level of basic confidence in the political system and in politicians to, you know, to get stuff done, that meant it was, there was a much more natural default swing that meant that once you were fed up with the Tories, you voted Labour. And that is no longer the case. And also just in terms of, you know, things we've discussed before, both the performance capability, but also I think having an intellectual conception of what the argument you're trying to make was stronger in the mid 90s in the top Labour Party than it is with Keir Starmer. And it is in terms therefore of, you know, will there be a butterfly out of the chrysalis on the, whenever it is, the 1st of May 2025, it actually has to be before then. Look, I'm afraid I've watched Labour in opposition, as I'm sure we all have, enough, and people have talked about this potential candidate or that one, and we've all done the thing of holding someone up to the light a certain way, and if you squint and blink, maybe you see this thing that's not, look, you know, I think what you see is what you get, and I think, you know, he will, if he does become prime minister, he will have an opportunity to enact some useful progressive policies. But will he suddenly discover the evangelical capability to persuade a lot of people who are right now still either alarmed by or skeptical about a kind of social democratic politics, that actually that is what this country really needs? If he was able to do it, he'd be doing it already. Sorry, that sounds really pessimistic, but I think, he doesn't mean he won't become prime minister. Doesn't mean he'll be a bad prime minister, but he won't be the prime minister that fundamentally changes the frame of British politics to move it back from the place it's got to on the far right. But move back a bit, obviously, but not as far as we'd like, maybe.
Okay, so I am surprised that, Raf, you are so into, you know, the marketplace of ideas and all of that, but your concept of pluralism stops when it comes to the Labour left. I think we need to start getting rid of this bogeyman framing that you and others seem to have created around Corbyn. Look, millions of people up and down the country do not accept the definition of Corbyn that you've just conjured up. They voted Labour in 2017 and millions still voted in 2019 because they liked the policies. They liked the idea of renationalisation. They liked higher tax on the highest earners. They liked support for the NHS. They liked support for public services. They liked fair pay for workers. And to say to all of those people, well, I'm very sorry, but the left is just toxic, don't you know, and we have to get rid of them. It's just nonsense. It's political nonsense, and you need to stop saying it. I'm not...
Sorry, I didn't say the left. I didn't say the left. I said Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, just him or all of the people who say they support him? Because that's what's happening right now, and you know that.
It is an electoral reality. But let's not really scale this. It is a fact of what happened in the 2019 general election that Boris Johnson won a stonking majority because so many people could not bring themselves to contemplate the idea of making Jeremy Corbyn prime minister. That is a cephalological fact of what happened in that election. And you can find other ways to describe what happened in that election that would present that as not the case, but it is the case. And if Labour doesn't accept that, then it's just going to be a longer journey back to power.
What you are saying is because Corbyn the person was made toxic in that election, we have to get rid of the entire left to make the party presentable and elected.
No, I'm not saying that.
Okay, so where do we stop? Is it get rid of Corbyn or is it get rid of anyone who supports Corbyn? Is it lock candidates out of selections because they're too left or because they looked nicely at Corbyn once? Because you know and I know that that's exactly what's happening right now. So where do we stop with that?
I think it was important for the Labour Party and for Keir Starmer to understand and articulate that Jeremy Corbyn, in a number of respects, had made the Labour Party unelectable.
So, I think there is an argument, and this is the platform he stood on, which was effectively Corbynism without Corbyn. And that was a platform that you could have taken the policies and the values and presented them in a way that was acceptable to the majority. At the moment, it doesn't look like we're going to get that. And just to wrap up, I mean, I'm very struck, and this is a fear that I've got, that this is not, this is really kind of deeper democracy or barbarism times. And my worry, Raf, is that all Starmer will do will slow the descent into hell, or he might accelerate it, because if progressives get in and don't deliver on climate change, on inequality, on all the things that people want, people will go, okay, we tried the democracy stuff, let's try the other guys who just tell us, you know, who to follow and who to hate. That's, and I think this feels like we're moving to a crunch time. And that isn't an optimistic thing, but that gives a very binary, we either deepen democracy or we go to the authoritarian right. And maybe just any reflections on that, and how, well, let's do a hopeful thing. What can we do to get ourselves out of, you know, to take the right path or the left path or the democratic path? What are the big things that we could do? Raf, go on.
Well, I think that is perhaps too pessimistic. I mean, it's clearly a hazard, but at the moment, just the way things currently stand, there is a higher, I think it's more likely than not that there will be a Labour Prime Minister within 2 years, and the Conservatives will be in opposition. And then once they are in opposition, they could tear themselves apart in a fratricidal frenzy that would actually give Labour the opportunity to do exactly that sort of reframing, you know, change, do the thing that New Labour basically failed to do, actually, which is to use power to actually shift the narrative of politics in the frame. And that is entirely available. And, you know, we did briefly mention Scotland, but, you know, there are reasons to believe that actually with a Labour majority, all sorts of things could happen in this country that would mean that you do have two terms of Labour government, which, for all the disappointments and for all the fact that it is not going to deliver the 2017 or the 2019 Labour manifesto to the satisfaction of people who did vote for that, it's going to be a hell of a lot better than having another term of Tory government, you know, just so. And I don't see exactly what the alternative is if your despair is this is all completely screwed and he's such a disappointment that then you throw your hands up. But what do? You it doesn't seem to be, that doesn't seem to be a prescription for doing anything, which is,
I mean, not as bad as the Tories is such a low bar. My goodness. I actually completely agree with Neil. That is exactly my fear. I want a Labour government. I'm not sitting here going, oh, I hope Keir loses. My fear is, what are you going to do when you're in power? Because if you do not very much, it's just going to be worse for everyone. They're going to say, well, we tried having faith in you politicians and you're all the same as each other. What is the point? Let's go even further to the right. And that's especially going to happen if Labour doesn't even attempt to counter the very toxic far right framing around issues like immigration. And it's not even attempting to do any of that. And so that is precisely my fear, that they'll get into power, but actually they won't do anything and we'll end up with something much worse. When I think about where the hope comes from, and I saw some people put that in the comment, I mean, it comes from us. Like, it's incumbent on us, if and when they get into power, to drag them, kicking and screaming if need be, into better policy positions, because that is the reality that we face. This is crunch time. This is not a game. It's not a joke. This is on people's skin and on people's lives. So yeah, it's going to be incumbent upon all of us. And I think about when Bernie Sanders was in town and he was explaining the success of Biden and why the president opted to work with within the socialists within the Democratic Party. And he was talking about how Biden was prepared to think big and not small because he understood that people around the country were in pain, and he spoke to that. And I think that's the key. You know, we've got to find a way to speak to that, to address that as a movement, as a progressive force. We've got to find a conversation and a policy offer that matches that. And I think that's the road that Starmer, I mean, it would be great if that were the road that Starmer decided to travel along.
Let's make him travel that road. Let's build our ideas, our leaders and our movements to do that. Thank you, both of you. You were absolutely brilliant. I knew that you would be, and you didn't disappoint at all. So thanks so much for your great answers. Thanks, everyone, for your great questions. And the chat has just been amazing. I've been flicking through it. The chat's better than anything that I've ever said. So thanks, everyone. The next podcast will be at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, the 9th of May, when we'll reflect on the week before's local elections, Raf's data set that he's looking forward to. What do they tell us about who's likely to win the next election and the state of cross-party cooperation, the big thing for us? We'll be joined by longtime pollster and writer Peter Kellner, but we'll also be joined by a number of local Compass activists who have been contesting the elections and trying to build progressive alliances to defeat the Tories. So make sure you're tuned in to that next podcast. Until then, thanks again, Raf and Rachel. Thanks, Harry. Thanks to all of our members on the call tonight. If you're listening in, you want to join live next time, but you haven't joined us yet, please do so. You need us to help to win a good society, and we need everyone needs a compass to navigate these complex times. Until then, everyone, keep hopeful, keep determined. Good night. Go back to your living room safely. So, if you like what you've heard today and want to be part of a much more equal, democratic and sustainable future, a good society, then visit us at compassonline.org.uk/podcast, and you'll be able to join us live on future calls just like this one. You can tweet me at Neil, N-E-A-L underscore compass, or compass at Compass Office. And if you've enjoyed this week's episode, please give us a rating. It will help us reach more listeners in the future. And it's only fair that they know it's bloody complicated too.